perfect timing. Luck of the Irish again, right?
Yeah. How often do you get to say that one?
About every day.
What's up, everybody? It is episode 231 of Bourbon Pursuit. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny, and we've got just a little bit of news to go through. Four Roses, like every other distillery out there, is trying to figure out what do you do with old barrels, and there are all kinds of breweries across the nation that just want to gobble them up. And Four Roses is collaborating with Brooklyn Brewery for a new limited release beer called Black Ops. Now, I've seen it before, but this one's a little bit different because this vintage of Brooklyn Black Ops was aged for 4 months in Four Roses small batch barrels that were then selected by master distiller Brent Elliott and re-fermented with champagne yeast. This Russian Imperial Stout comes at 12.4 ABV, raises a fluffy dark brown head, combines big chocolate and coffee notes with a rich underpinning of vanilla-like oak. Brooklyn Black Ops will be available in limited quantities wherever Brooklyn Brewery is available. A new development is happening in downtown Louisville with a new website that offers an interactive map, a whole list of attractions featuring downtown distilleries like Old Forester, Angel's Envy, Michter's, plus a whole gallery of pictures. It's called the Bourbon District. There are flagpoles and information signs going up around downtown, around the city that give information, history, and directions to all the bourbon-related happenings in downtown Louisville. You can check it out online at bourbonism.com. That's like tourism, but bourbonism.com. Ryan and myself, we traveled down to Lynchburg, Tennessee this week to go and pick our first ever single barrel of Jack Daniel's. We've heard so much about these single barrels being stag killers that we just had to go out and try it for ourselves. We're really looking forward to bringing this barrel selection along with many others to our Patreon community in 2020. And right now, our goal is set at 20 barrels selected for the Patreon community in the next calendar year. And with the holidays approaching, it's a good time to think about how fortunate we are that we get to enjoy this great hobby of bourbon. With the help of the Bourbon Pursuit Patreon community and the fellows on the roundtable, we've kicked off our first ever Christmas charity raffle. Go to bourbonpursuit.com/Christmas to see all the packages that we have lined up. There's bottles of Pursuit Series Episode 17, which was our collaboration with Willett Distillery, a Maker's Mark 46 private selection that we did, a Russell's Reserve from Rare Bird 101, a Michter's Barrel Strength Rye, Elijah Craig Barrel Proof, the old label, Traverse City collaboration from Bourboner, as well as Breaking Bourbon, and even more bottles. There's also apparel, glassware, tasting sheets, a complete signed copies of all the books that have come from Fred Minnick, as well as a signed copy from Sippin' Corn of Brian Hara as well. Every dollar raised is going to the USO and Pets for Vets. Both of these organizations do incredible things for our veterans and their families. Every entry gives you a chance to win any of the prize packages that we have, and of course, you must be 21 years old or older to enter. Entries are accepted until midnight of December 22nd, 2019. So please, go visit bourbonpursuit.com/Christmas to get in on the action and help out veterans in this holiday season. Now for today's podcast, Connor O'Driscoll, he's beginning to make a name for himself in this bourbon world. After spending his career at Brown-Forman and Angel's Envy, he was recruited to fulfill the role left behind by Denny Potter. Connor is now the 7th master distiller in Heaven Hill's 84-year history. We spent some time getting to know Connor's past, what the recruitment looks like, even like that whole process to even find a new master distiller, and what his role is going to be with the operation side of things, and how at the end of the day, he just doesn't want to screw anything up. All right, let's kick off the podcast. Here's Joe from Barrel Craft Spirits, and then you've got Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Joe Beatrice, founder of Barrel Craft Spirits. We enjoy finding and identifying barrels that contain distinctive traits and characteristics. We then bottle them at cask strength to retain their authentic qualities for the whiskey enthusiast. Next time, ask your bartender for barrel bourbon.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. As a journalist, I get pitched a lot of stories, and over the past 15 years, you know, in covering the booze business in one shape or another, I have received about every pitch you can possibly imagine, from celebrities to new nightclubs, you know, to the fads like White Claw in every kind of vodka flavor you can imagine, and yada, and on, and on, and on, and on. One of the latest trends in the booze industry is one of the more fascinating trends that I have ever seen, and that is Dry January, and this entire belief that the alcohol industry needs to start preaching and talking about not drinking. And what's interesting about this is that you would say, you could take a step back and say, well, if you encourage people to not consume alcohol, wouldn't that hurt the industry? But the counter to that is, take a look at what happens when you drink too much. People die. People die of liver poisoning. There's certain types of cancers that are linked to drinking too much alcohol. There's all kinds of problems that can be linked to overconsumption. And by overconsumption, I'm talking 5 to 7 drinks a day, you know, getting drunk every day, binge drinking to the point of where you have to get your stomach pumped on a regular basis. I mean, these are real issues that people face. And to counter that, the alcohol industry has been promoting mocktails and dry January. Now, I'm torn because I'm a firm believer in drinking moderation. And I'm a firm believer in just being responsible. And it's something in our, there's something in our country's DNA that we don't allow ourselves to really have a conversation about what is responsibility. Even the brands, they're all saying, yada, 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 drink responsibly. Don't drink and drive, all this. But what is drinking responsibly? Well, they'll say, well, it's having 2 drinks. But again, what is it? Is it, you know, drinking, not drinking when you're emotionally, you know, inspired or connected to something? Is it not drinking on anniversaries? Is it just having 1 drink and, you know, maybe you just got married or you're celebrating something? Can you have 5 drinks then? I mean, no one really talks about what drinking responsibly is. They just have their taglines. And now this whole effort about, you know, mocktails and dry January, it makes me question if we truly know what we're trying to do in this business when it comes to encouraging moderation. Because if you ask me, getting people to not drink during January has the opposite effect. That's teaching abstinence. That's not moderation. And that's this week's Above the Char. Hey, if you have an idea for Above the Char, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram at Fred Minnick and check out my new YouTube series on YouTube. Just search my name, Fred Minnick. Until next week, cheers.
Welcome back to the episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan here, and this is the first time I think Ryan might have been to this office in this conference room because
no.
Oh, you haven't? You've been here
yeah,
before?
Yeah, I've been here with Bernie Levers.
Oh, we were
not in this conference room.
Yeah, I remember
it wasn't
that.
This red.
Yeah, because I was like, we had Larry on last time, and you know, so we were at the I don't, if you call it the marketing offices, it's the business offices of Heaven Hill that are located here in Louisville, Kentucky. It's catty corner to the Maker's Mark offices, so they're always spying on each other to kind of figure out what's happening over there and stuff like that.
I guess Bardstown's just not good enough for them. They gotta, you know, come to Louisville. I don't know why.
I mean,
I totally get it. There's way more lunch spots and places to take people.
Yeah, there's more than Mammy's. But, you know, the other thing is, you know, I also feel bad for a lot of these people that do have to work in these multiple locations because you're driving a lot back and forth to whether it's the distillery, whether it's the offices, because you know, we're not going to Bardstown. We all happen to be here in Louisville, so it made sense to come here. But I know that you know, our guest today, he's got to go to the Bernheim Distillery. He's got to come here. He's got to go to the Heritage Center. He's making the trifecta of all the places he has to hit up.
I guess we'll find out if that's one of the perks. You know, you get mileage or
mileage.
Gas reimbursement or company car when you're a master distiller. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So with that, let's go ahead and introduce our guest. So today we have Connor O'Driscoll. Connor is the newest minted master distiller at Heaven Hill. He is also the 5th master distiller that's been crowned at Heaven Hill. So
congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Technically, I'm 7th.
Seventh? Is that what it was?
Yeah, okay. 5th in the Shapira era.
5th in the Shapira era.
But
okay.
7th in the Heaven Hill.
See, that's what happens when you get Wikipedia information.
Yeah,
somebody didn't update it.
The Google food just wasn't on my side this morning.
Yep.
So Connor, welcome to the show. It's great
to have you.
Great
to be here. Really honored to be here.
Yeah, I mean, we've met before. We talked.
We dined and
we had
some booze.
We didn't wine and dine. We whiskeyed and dined.
Whiskeyed and dined. Yeah.
What was that? What was it?
That was at Raw.
Yeah, it was. What was it?
That was my debutante.
Get to know Connor kind of night is what it was. So
yep.
And you
we must have made an impression and invite us back.
Vice versa, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And I could understand, like, it's got to be difficult coming into a situation like this and seeing a product portfolio that's the breadth in front of you and saying, like, okay, now I've got to be the face of this.
Yeah. Don't screw it up.
Bingo. I mean, that literally was the guiding mantra, the first, well, it still is, don't screw it up. But you mentioned the portfolio. The other places I worked are, great whiskeys, but it was like one whiskey, maybe two or three. And now you come to Heaven Hill and there's a lot. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I'm still learning the portfolio, but what a fun facet of the job to learn the portfolio.
Yeah. Well, not only have bourbon, you have like, and I'm not sure if you do it, but all the different brands, vodka, rums, brandies.
I'm still learning the whiskey end of things. So yeah. We got our five mash bills that go into multiple different SKUs. Everything from, Mellow corn whiskey, all the way up to Heaven Hill 27 with all the fantastic products in between there.
Sure.
So before we get started on the products, we want to kind of get to know more about you because I can't pin it down. Exactly what region from Texas are you from?
Very, very far eastern Texas. So far east across the Atlantic. I grew up in Dublin in Ireland. So the joke is they put an Irishman in charge of the whiskey. Mm-hmm. Am I living the dream or am I living the stereotype? to be determined. So yeah, I grew up in Dublin, went to school there, got my degree in chemical engineering there. And actually started my career with Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in Cork on the south coast of Ireland. I'd been with them for, I forget, not quite a year. And they asked me to go to Terre Haute, Indiana. For a six-month assignment.
Are you going to work for John Deere or something?
No, they had a – actually, it was kind of cool. For a guy straight out of college, we were using a genetically engineered genetically engineered bacteria to make the enzyme to make cheese, and it was a fermentation based process. So, again, for a kid straight out of college, this was bleeding edge technology. And
it's amazing that you're like, this was exciting. Like, these were exciting times.
The product was exciting. The process was exciting.
Yeah.
And it was in Terre Haute. But it was supposed to be a 6-month assignment. 4 months in, they asked me to stay, and 6 years later, I quit. So it wasn't so awful that I couldn't stay there for 6 years. The people I worked with are fantastic. Still friends with some of them. I guess the real thing that kept me there was I reconnected with some friends from Louisville and started coming down here on the weekends. And probably had it not been for that, the lure of Terre Haute would not have been strong enough to keep me there. But, got to know Louisville very well, got to know the road from Terre Haute to Louisville really, really well. And, like I said, after 6 years in Terre Haute, I quit. And spent that summer riding my motorcycle across the country.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Still have it. It's a 93 Super Glide.
You a Harley guy?
I'm a Harley guy. Okay. Like I said, 93 Super Glide. Spent 7 weeks that summer riding 11,098 miles. As I was heading back towards Indiana, I realized it was going to be very close to 11,000 miles. I said, if I don't make 11,000 miles, I'm riding around a block till I do make 11,000 miles. But I ended up in 11,000.
That's like me with my Fitbit. Every day I'm like, all right,
it's 10 or 11,000 miles. Steps, yeah, it's kind of the same thing. But I was in Mexico, Canada, and 23 states in between.
Wow.
In 7 weeks. So it was pretty cool.
It's quite an epic road trip.
It was epic. It was really cool.
So kind of talk a little bit more about the road trip. Was there any like other sites that you're like amazed to see? I know for me personally, people always talk about going and seeing like the Grand Canyon. For me, I remember going and seeing the Grand Canyon. You get there and you're like, all right, let's get out of here. Like, we've seen it.
Well, so the genesis of the trip was 1996 was the 75th anniversary of Route 66. So Harley organized this rolling rally, they called it. Started in Milwaukee, where Harleys are built. Came into Chicago, picked up Route 66, and then followed it west to Santa Monica. There's not much left of Route 66, but they had a historian with us, who every evening would talk about, you know, what we'd seen today, what we're going to see tomorrow. And there was 400 and some bikes did it end to end. I was one of them. And then there was thousands you could join anywhere along the way. So I remember riding into like Tucumcari, New Mexico, and just as far as you could see in front and as far as you could see behind, a double line of Harleys. So that was very cool. But, you know, got to see, you know, all kinds of the U.S. And especially, you mentioned the Grand Canyon. I mean, I've been to the Grand Canyon three times, twice on my Harley. And one, and the first time was on this ride. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's pretty stunning to see it.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about the U.S. on that trip? That, like, vastness. You know, before, I guess coming from a different country, you know, you probably have preconceived notions about what it's going to be like, here, or yeah, what, you know.
I'd been in the States for 6 years and had taken multiple road trips, you know, out west and wherever. But to see it from the back of a Harley and to see it for that long, you know, I rode every inch of Highway 1, the Pacific Coast Highway, you know, from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. I rode over Independence Pass. I rode across the desert in Texas. You know, there's one stretch of highway there where, you know, it's 100 miles between gas stations. And my bike's got about 130 mile range.
Yeah, better fill up.
So stuff like that. Top her off, yeah. So just, the vastness, the variety, you know, to go from, you know, sea level to 14,000 feet, or well, it's not 14 to 12,000 feet at Independence mm-hmm. Pass, to go from the Pacific Northwest to Texas desert, you know, just stunning.
Well, yep. It's a little bit different than Ireland too, because at least in Ireland, if you do that kind of driving, at least you see castles. You're not seeing castles anywhere across the U.S. like that.
Not really. Well, Hearst Castle. I think I saw Hearst Castle.
Just Holiday Inns.
Just Holiday Inns.
Yeah, stayed at a lot of Holiday Inns. Yeah.
So kind of talk about what's that next evolution of your journey. How did you get into, I mean, you were doing the cheese thing, you stopped.
And it wasn't quite, I was the precursor. I was doing the enzyme thing.
I know, it sounds really bad. I'm like, you're doing that cheese thing.
Yeah. Well, we were in the cheese supply chain, put it that way. You know, the process I worked on in Ireland was fermentation based. This one in Terre Haute was fermentation based. And after the motorcycle trip, I ended up in Colorado and skied all winter. And then got my career going again. And I said,
you must have had an awesome severance package.
I had saved smartly. I got no severance package, but I had saved smartly. And I learned to live cheap again.
Yeah, so, that's awesome.
So when I got my career going again, I said, well, I'll try this production thing. I'll try engineering and like the design end of things, and did that for another 6 years. And that was less fulfilling, let's say. It was very Dilbertian. Mm-hmm. Is that a word? It is now.
Dilbert, we'll take the new terminology.
There you go. But it was, you know, sitting in a cubicle, that type of thing. By this point, I was married, and I'd always said that you know, I was going to stay in the U.S. as long as it was fun, and you know, once it was no longer fun, I'd leave. But of course, you know,
you're still here,
still fun. Transcontinental motorcycle trip, pretty fun. Winter skiing, pretty fun. You know, my wife's still fun. 20 years later, 21 years later. So, you know, I said if it had quit being fun, I would go back to Dublin and try and get a job making Guinness, because that would be fun. Mm-hmm. And once I realized I wasn't leaving, and like I said, I was getting tired of this, the engineering end of things. So I go, well, what's next? You know, where should I take my career? And like I said, the Guinness thing was in the back of my mind. Of course, it's not the closest thing, but, you know, kind of along that arc, this bourbon thing seems kind of cool. So that was in 2002 when I really started thinking about it. But, you know, long before any boom, long before, mm-hmm. you know, any even hint of the boom, you know, Woodford had been in existence for, 6 years at that point? That's how long ago it was. So I started knocking on doors, and it literally took 2 years before guy called Leo Riedinger, who had run what's now the Brown-Forman Distillery, he retired, and everybody ratcheted up one and opened a position, and I was lucky enough to get hired into that. And the previous person hired into that job was my boss, who had been hired 26 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. So that's how slow the industry was then. But Brown-Forman hired me, and it was like, woohoo, dream job. And I spent 5 years in Shively, you know, I learned how to run a distillery, how to make whiskey. In 2008, 2009, around then, they sent me out to Woodford. And again, Woodford was tiny then. But the boom was probably, it was probably starting then, or had started, and it was starting to pick up some momentum.
Yeah, that's when you kind of start seeing a lot of the uptick and rise of people just visiting the distilleries and stuff like that. Not so much the craze we see today of bottles just flying off the shelf, a more of an interest from the average consumer, and probably nearing the time too when a lot of distilleries were thinking like, oh, we probably need a visitor center.
So Woodford did have a visitor center, which was kind of cool. But you mentioned the uptick in visitors. That literally was the first thing we saw. I think at that point, the visitor center had been designed for maybe 30,000 visitors a year. And the Bourbon Trail came on right around then and really kicked things up. And, there weren't that many visitor centers, and Woodford had the newest, nicest one. Mm-hmm. And, that wasn't quite the ground floor of Woodford, but it was pretty close to it. So to be there at that point in the industry's growth and in Woodford's growth was just, perfect timing. Mm-hmm. Luck of the Irish again, right?
Yeah. How often do you get to say that one?
About every day. like I said, from 2009 till, 2 years ago, 17, was at Woodford. Did most of that was, running the distillery. Did a lot of cool things. Worked with a lot of cool people. Learned a ton. It was gratifying, exciting, thrilling to be part of the growth of that brand. Like I said, when I went out there, it was tiny. By the time I left, we were shipping over 1 million cases a year. Mm-hmm. And, it had become what it is now, or, close to what it is now.
You still had a hand in a lot of the product that's still coming out today and everything like that.
When I left there, people said, what are you going to do with all the bourbon? All the Woodford you have? And I was like, drink it. And it's good for at least another 7 years. I have confidence it'll be good for a long time. It's still a good team out there. So,
yeah, I was about to say, speaking of the team, I mean, talk about a relationship or time with Chris Morris or anything like that, because I know that you probably had some sort of interaction with him.
Yeah, we worked very closely together, and what a cool guy to work with. I mean, his knowledge of the industry and, he was clearly the tip of the spear in the growth of Woodford and in the guidance of its growth. The Master's Collections, I was lucky enough to have a hand in those and, make several of those, but they are all his brain children. And, to work closely with him and the rest of the team as well. And, Elizabeth McCall, who's now the system master distiller, she worked with me for a while at Woodford, and that was a lot of fun. She's cool.
Yeah.
Seems like you're all
a little tight-knit family. You guys is there Christmas cards that go back and forth every year too?
We just exchange bottles.
So I'm curious, when you get into, distilling, like you said, you came from the enzyme fermentation. Yeah. Like, is there like that when you show up, is there like, all right, here's the training manual and let's go
page by page? Especially back then, because, when you haven't hired someone for 26 years, there's no onboarding manual. There's no new guy manual. So it was, kind of seat of the pants stuff. I followed Glenn Glazer was my boss, learned a ton from him, followed him around every day like a lost puppy. Worked with the operators, kind of sat and asked them. Those are the guys who turn the valves and, run the show. So, sit with them and learn from them and just kind of be a sponge, soak it up.
So is it kind of like station? So like this month I'm going to be focusing on how to turn these valves next month.
It's all inclusive. It's kind of in depth. And I remember, by the time I joined Brown-Forman, I'd worked in production for 6 or 7 years. I'd done design engineering, across multiple different industries for another 6 years. So, hired in and, Glenn said it's going to take a good 2 years to really understand this process. And I was like, as if. And literally 2 years to the day, I was like, I think I'm starting to get this. But it's just, when you think about making whiskey, you get grain, you mill it, mash it, ferment it, distill it, put it in a barrel. five easy steps. But then you get in a distillery and everything's scheduled on top of itself. And there's, you've got to do this first, but you got to wait for that. And then you've got to worry about byproducts and is your yeast up to speed and blah, 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 blah. So getting the integration of all those parts and the timing of all those parts and just the getting everything to work in concert and understanding all the multiple nuances of that. That's where the, those are the details, and that's where the devil is.
So it's like Malcolm Gladwell's rule of 10,000 hours. So
yeah, to be, it kind of is. When I read that book, a lot of it rang true.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm not familiar with the book.
Oh, it's just had that to be an expert. Really, if you have 10,000 hours, like that's where you achieve mastery in any subject. But so.
Well, that's good to know. So. Yeah.
I got about another 9,000.
So there's 2,000. If you do 40 hours a week, there's 2,000 working hours in a year. So if you're just doing the bare minimum, it'll take you 5 years.
But, yeah. So,
but I'm sure you're working more than that.
Oh,
so
way more accelerated.
So we got a while until we figure out this podcasting thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We're only like 500 hours.
Well, I mean, it's a good way to kind of see how you grew up and you learned the industry from the inside of Brown-Forman. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people, we take tours and you go through and they really dumb it down. And as exactly as you said, they take the five steps and like, this is the process. However, there's so many intricacies with inside of that process that you had just talked about. You know, during your time there, what was one of those intricacies that you said, like, okay, this is going to take more time to figure out. Like this is where the variables tend to change a lot, that sort of thing.
So the easiest example of that is, the optimizing yeasting, mashing, fermentation at Woodford. When I got there, they were running fermenters. We were making whiskey. Everything was trotting along just fine. And like we talked earlier, this is kind of as the boom was starting up, and I was looking at ways to increase productivity in the distillery. So one of the easiest ways to increase productivity is to put more grain in the fermenters. Still doing everything exactly the same way. There's just more grain in there. Therefore, there's more food for the yeast. Therefore, they can make more alcohol. Therefore, you can fill more barrels. So talking with my colleague Kevin Smith down at Jack Daniels, who for every 5 minutes that I could talk about yeasting, he could talk for 5 hours, and just, he's a fascinating guy and just a font of knowledge. But I remember having a casual conversation with him about increasing the beer gallonage and the amount of grain in the fermenters, and he says, "Well, before you do that," and he was very polite about it, he says, "Before you do that, you're going to have to fix your yeasting." I was like, "Nothing wrong with our yeasting." I said, apparently I spent a lot of my early career going, like,
I know.
And I was like, we've set a fermenter and hours later it bubbles and then days later we get whiskey out of it. And, he very politely disabused me of that. And that was step one in a 2-year process to get from where it was a very crude way of managing yeast that was actually doing more to hamper the yeast than it was to optimize it. But like I said, 2 years into it, and the fermenter productivity was up, 25%. The whiskey quality was off the charts. The rates of fermenter contamination were about zero. You could walk in the distillery and just smell how good it was. And from a initial notion of let's put some more grain in the fermenter to 2 years later, again, aha, I think we're finally turning the corner here.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there were some short-term gains that are immediate gains. Like, all right, we're on the right path. But to really, get it from a system that might have been, let's call it 85% efficient to 90% efficient to 95% efficient to 98% efficient, to really start tweaking in the details there.
Yeah, so yeast, I mean, I guess it's, you probably have a good idea of what it's going to do based on experience, but it's a living thing. So are there times that you're just like, what the hell is going on? Like, I did everything right and it's just like gone to shit.
If you do everything right, it won't. So if it goes to shit, then something's gone wrong.
Okay.
Is the bottom line. The easiest way to think about it, I mean, the yeast makes all the alcohol and a good chunk of the flavor. So if you treat the yeast right, she'll treat you right back. And, best quote on that, I was doing a Camp Runamuck group at Woodford, and I had to give a 15-minute master class in yeasting mashing fermentation three times a day. But one of the groups, the young lady on it, after I gave my yeasting spiel, so she said, "So around here, yeast is queen." I was like, "Yes, that's exactly it. That's the perfect way to put it." So again, you treat the yeast right, you know, she'll treat you right back. And you know, that's kind of the goal.
So let's move to the next stage in your journey here. So Brown-Forman, your time there was done in 2017. I think you had a little bit of stint at Angel's Envy as well.
I did.
So, talk about that.
Yeah. So I was kind of plodding along, doing my thing at Woodford, and you know, by this stage, I was running the warehousing and processing. So another chunk of the industry, learning something new. We were building the new warehouses at Woodford, so you know, kind of overseeing that and understanding how to operate these giant warehouses. But once we got that system down, it kind of became rote. And I was like, all right, you know, what else is out there? You know, I've had 14 really fantastic years at Brown-Forman. You know, is there anything within Brown-Forman? Is there anything without? And right as I was thinking these things, a former Brown-Forman colleague, a former Woodford colleague, who is now at Angel's Envy, she called me and said, "Hey, we may have a position. Are you interested?" So I went down there on a Saturday morning, very surreptitiously, and kind of looked around. And they heard they were, you know, less than a year out of startup, and you know, brand new facility, but in an older building. You've been to the
It's gorgeous. They ran into a lot of issues getting that thing up and running too.
And they got through them all. Just everything about it kind of resonated with me.
You're like, yes, I don't have to drive to Versailles anymore.
That was a significant part of it, because by this point we had warehouses in Midway, so my commute was from Louisville to Midway, check in with the gang there, then come back to Versailles. And generally spend the rest of my day in Versailles, but occasionally bebop between the two of them and then come home. So getting close to 3 hours a day in the car.
Wow.
Audiobook time. You know,
podcast.
Before podcast. Yeah.
I was about to say, I was like, I know people in like LA and they do all those commutes every day in San Francisco. And I'm like, how do you sit in the car for an hour one way every single day? Like,
so I mean, I was doing highway speed, so it was relatively benign. And you know, for most of that time, I was driving to Woodford to make whiskey. You know, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
The first several months that I was at Angel's Envy, and I would drive home in 10 minutes, I'd literally sit in the garage and like,
what do I do now?
How did I get here? You know, like, and like, what do I do all this?
I guess I'm going to take a walk to listen to catch up on my podcast.
That or it's like, I better go to the bar home or go to the bar real quick because my wife's going to make me do a lot of chores and she knows I'll be home early.
I had dinner ready. So so that was a big win there. But, you know, love being part of Bacardi. It's interesting that the three companies I've worked for in this industry are all different facets of family owned. But
was Angel's Envy family owned when you started, or was it owned by
Bacardi?
Bacardi, gotcha.
But of course the Hendersons too,
right?
But it's, you know, it was fully owned by Bacardi then.
Gotcha.
And Bacardi bring a ton to the table. I mean, mm-hmm. they're truly a global company. Mm-hmm. We reported up through Geneva, and accounts payable were in Costa Rica, and SAP support was in the Philippines and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some time zone juggling, but that global perspective was pretty cool. And just the cultural diversity within the – I was at a meeting in Puerto Rico, and I was the closest thing to a Yankee in the room. And that was – and you know, you don't get that very often in Louisville.
Yeah.
And it was like, they're all speaking English for me because I'm the only one here who doesn't speak Spanish. Like, yeah, that's kind of embarrassing. But anyway, that was, you know, lots of positive things. You know, and again, just a different way of running the same industry. But Bacardi have a lot of cool things they do. You know, worked with a lot of just really smart, hardworking, fun people there. And of course, you know, seeing Angel, you know, I think when I came in, they were just coming out of that startup mode, and you know, I was tasked with kind of taking it out of that wild west, just run headlong at the problem till you fix it. All right, let's slow down, let's think about it, let's get a process in place, let's think about where we want to go and how we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. And just start you know, like I said, slapping a process on stuff.
This is an amateur question, but is distilling rum the same process as bourbon, but just different ingredients?
Different ingredients. It's basically the same. Okay. You ferment molasses.
Sure.
And,
right.
And but then, and of course, it's a shorter, faster. You don't have to mill anything. You don't have to necessarily mash anything. And then the aguardiente.
The
aguardiente.
Okay. What is that?
It's a fun word to say. It's the new make.
I gotcha.
And then, you know, it's aged in generally used barrels for a shorter period. And, of course, it's the heat of the Caribbean versus, you know, the seasonal cycles here.
Sure.
I kind of left before I really could deep dive into that process, but
you heard the word Bacardi and you're like, I got a question about that.
Exactly.
Let me throw him a curveball.
So the fermentation and distillation are very, very similar.
Well, we've never talked to a rum distiller. Yeah. So maybe
I've never been a rum distiller. I've said, right. But I saw one on TV. but no, the gang down there, Joe Gomez, the master blender down there, is just he is one of those icons of the industry. The nicest guy you'll ever meet will talk all day long about it, and just he wants to be your friend. You want to be his friend. Mm-hmm. And to get to spend time with people like him was cool. But then, like, the biggest difference, I guess, is in the aging.
Gotcha.
So
you talk about how he's the master blender. Do distillers here, are they in charge of blending as well?
With a career as a master distiller spanning almost 50 years, as well as a Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Famer and having over 100 million people taste his products, Steve Nally is a legend of bourbon who for years made maker's mark with expertise and precision. His latest project is with Bardstown Bourbon Company, a state-of-the-art distillery in the heart of the bourbon capital of the world. They're known for their popular Fusion series. However, they're adding something new in 2020 with a release named The Prisoner. It starts as a 9-year-old Tennessee bourbon that is then finished in The Prisoner Wine Company's French oak barrels for 18 months. The good news is you don't have to wait till next year to try it. Steve and the team at Bardstown Bourbon Company have teamed up with Rackhouse Whiskey Club. Rackhouse Whiskey Club is a Whiskey of the Month club on a mission to uncover the best flavors and stories that craft distilleries across the U.S. have to offer. Their December box, which will ship in time for Christmas, features a full-size bottle of Bardstown's Fusion Series and a 200-milliliter bottle of The Prisoner. There's also some cool merch inside, and as always, with this membership, shipping is free. Get your hands on some early release Bardstown bourbon by signing up at RackhouseWhiskeyClub.com. Use code PURSUIT for $25 off your first box. 291 Colorado Whiskey aims to create a one-of-a-kind, bold and beautiful Colorado whiskey. Rugged, refined, rebellious. Owner and founding distiller Michael Myers built the original still from copper photogravure plates, which he used to create enduring photographic scenes from Western landscapes to the Chrysler Building. On September 11th, 2011, 10 years after 9/11 changed his life and the lives of so many others, he pulled the first whiskey off that still, building a future in whiskey off his passion for photography. What defines 291 Colorado Whiskey is its spirit. Passion permeates every sip. Find a bottle near you at 291coloradowhiskey.com. Write it like you stole it, drink it like you own it. Live fast and drink responsibly.
So you talk about how he's the master blender. Do distillers here, are they in charge of blending as well? Or
generally speaking, so that's, you know, it's interesting. In rum, it's all about the blending. Mm-hmm. And that's why the focus is on master blenders. And if you look at the history of Bacardi, the Bacardi family members have generally come up through that supply chain, I guess, whatever you want to call it, through that route.
It's kind of like the Beams, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the people running the business know the business.
Mm-hmm.
But then on our side of it, in the bourbon, blended bourbon is kind of, it's still got that post-prohibition nasty connotation. So we're not so, we don't focus so much on the blending side of things. Although, you know, that is, you know, one stave to our barrel, as it were.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a common theme here, because I think this is probably an inhibitor to a lot of people that work in your type of scenario in this type of industry. It's hard to maybe make upward progression. Mm-hmm. Because there's people within these roles that are there for 10, 20, 30.
And there's only a handful of them.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
That, or you're in a situation where it is a family legacy. You've got the nose, you've got the Russells. Odds are they're not going to let some outsider come in.
They're not going to let Cecil come in.
Cecils aren't going to make Driscoll. Their way. and so you have this sort of like this cap on upwards mobility. And so you had your time at Angels Envy. So kind of talk about how this process came to be of interviewing at Heaven Hill and making some connections and kind of making your way into this role.
Well, so I'd known Alan through the industry, Alan Latz, our COO. I'd known him for several years, just through the industry, like I said. And, I was happy at Angels Envy. I was planning on going nowhere. I was not planning on going anywhere, whatever phrase
you want. Yeah.
And then the news broke that Denny had left. And, I mean, I was just as stunned as everybody else. But I didn't even think, like, ha, there's an opportunity for me. It's like, wow, Denny left. That's amazing. All right,
so you didn't call your agent? No. Can you start the negotiations?
Maybe I should have. but actually, it wasn't long after that it was Denny reached out to me. Because, again, I'd known Denny as long as I've been in this business. And he said, you know, he'd been asked to find some suitable candidates and, you know, thought of me. And I was like, wow, I'm so flattered. You know, I hadn't even thought about that, but wow. I thought about it and I was like, you know what? I've got a really good job here. I just made a big move 18 months ago. I'm going to stay here. And we chatted some more. Thanks very much. That was really flattering. And it was kind of one of those things, as soon as I hung up, I was like, damn it. Probably wasn't the right answer.
Yeah.
And then went home, told my wife about it, and she goes, yeah, that wasn't the right answer. So I forget if Alan called me next or if Denny called me back or what it was, but either way, we got back in touch again. I was like, yeah, let's talk. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense.
What were the hesitations?
The fact that I just made a big move,
yeah.
And I liked what I was doing at Angels Envy. I liked being part of Bacardi.
Yeah, it's always tough to be put in a situation like that. You feel like you're going to burn a bridge or something by coming in and
it's
out.
Like coaching in basketball. You know, somebody's at a mid-major, they're happy, they're doing well, and then you're like, but the big leagues is more appealing.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. And it's funny you say the big leagues. You know, that was kind of the catchphrase, if you will, that I boiled it down to. Like, my office at Angels Envy overlooked Slugger Field. Mm-hmm. So as I'm thinking through this, it's like, all right, I'm pitching AAA and doing fine pitching AAA. And like, Boston Red Sox and New York Yankees just called. I just said no to the New York Yankees. Yeah, don't say no to the New York Yankees.
Yeah.
So luckily, the New York Yankees weren't upset that I had said no the first time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked backwards and forwards, and the more...
You played hard to get is what it was.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. But, you know, throw whatever cliches you want at it. The more I thought about it, just the more it made sense. So this is just the legacy of Heaven Hill, the career progression, the whole thing just kind of came together at that point. And I was like, this is a once in a career opportunity. If I turn this down, I'll never get this again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I'm truly going to take my career to where I think it should go, this is the opportunity. And so far, so good.
Yeah, it's kind of like you're also in a position like you're a Supreme Court judge. Like you've been placed in a position where, like, unless you really screw up, like you're pretty, like, there's and unless this whole thing like tanks and there's a nuclear like breakout, like, you're going to be pretty well set in regards of having a good living.
If there is nuclear war, we've got bigger things to worry about.
Yeah. But,
I'm sure yeast will survive.
Right.
No, it's not quite, I haven't kind of docked the ship and I'm done. You know, there's mm-hmm. a lot of work to be done, a lot of cool work to be done. I'm not going to, you know, I haven't reached a point where I can, you know, glide into retirement or even if I want to, or rest on my laurels or any of that, mm-hmm. or, you know, just sit on the shoulders of those who came before me. You know, there's a lot left to be done.
What are some of the like sacrifices or I guess parts of the job that, you know, when you're working at Brown-Forman, you're kind of behind the scenes, you're not having to deal with a lot of stuff that
podcasts and nonsense like that.
Like showing up with these idiots and like, gosh, they're taking up an hour of my day. But
I could be tasting samples right now.
Yeah.
I guess talk about that. Like, you know, cause when you're, you, like you said, when you go to the big leagues, you're giving up a lot. What are some of those things?
So, you know, not so much giving up, I think, but, you know, they're, you know, I think in any career, as you move up the food chain, you've got to learn to delegate and either hope that you've got a good team behind you or, you know, engineer a good team. And in this case, I don't have to hope. I do have a great team. I mean, this distillery's been running for a long time before I got here, making award-winning whiskey for a long time. So my job is to kind of slide in, pick up the reins, and, you know, keep that going on that upward arc.
Yeah, there was a time period between you and Denny, so it seems like York, it was still running. The still, yeah, still yeah, running. Nothing, between that,
nothing
time.
Stopped.
Yeah, no, and nothing did stop. And that's, it's like the you know, the supervisors that are there on every shift, the team members on the shift, the maintenance guys, the whole crew. I mean, you know, we're lucky enough to have, you know, a painter and a janitor there,
yeah,
and they work hard to keep the place looking clean, and they're as important to the operation, probably more important than I am, but
yeah,
you know, it's they're a good team. They work hard, they care, and that was you know, when Alan took me in to show me around the distillery on a Saturday morning. Everything was done on Saturday mornings, very surreptitious. you know, you could pick up. I mean, the crew members who were there that day were happy to see him, and you know, they clearly were into what they were doing. And at that, you know, we run 7 days a week, and they work 7 days a week, and they are happy to do that. You know, like I said, so they care, they're passionate, they want to continue to make award winning whiskeys.
Yeah, so. when you have a distillery like Heaven Hill, like you said, it's such a legacy, great brands, incredible products, mm-hmm. and like you're like, all right, here's my baby, and they've been doing it so great. But do you look for ways to like improve the process, or look for ways like to put your own fingerprint on it?
He's got at least 2 years before he changes everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Or do you have to do the 10,000 hours again?
No, hopefully it doesn't reset to zero. No, I think, it's, like I said, it's pick up the reins and keep things going. There's always opportunities for improvement. Mm-hmm. You know, go back to what I was talking about at Woodford. I mean, Woodford is making good whiskey before I came along, and I had the opportunity to, you know, start optimizing. You know, where the Bernheim distillery now is obviously further ahead than where Woodford was in those days, but there are still opportunities to, you know, just to continuously improve.
And speaking of opportunities, talk about what was that learning opportunity or learning curve of coming in, because Ryan and I, we've been to the Bernheim distillery, we've toured it, and we know like the massive scale of what happens there. And so kind of talk about, was that sort of like a, whoa, this is pretty big, because I know it basically makes Angel's Envy look like a dwarf at that point.
Compare that to Woodford, then.
Yeah. So kind of talk about that.
So, I mean, the scale of the Bernheim distillery is stunning. I mean, we have 17 fermenters that are 124,000 gallons each. We fill four of those a day, and obviously we empty four of those a day. So that's the bones of 1 million gallons of liquid we're pumping around every day. We're mashing over 16,000 bushels a day, which is over 900,000 pounds of grain a day. That's about 20-ish loads of grain to unload every day.
Now I know why there's like 650,000 barrel warehouses popping up on bars down the road.
Yeah, we have 58 warehouses with over 1.6 million barrels in them. You know, at the Bernheim site, we have 480,000 barrels. And, you know, we're building a new 50,000, 55,000 barrel warehouse about every 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, we're laying down 1,300 barrels a day, and we're probably dumping, I know we're dumping less than that. We're probably dumping on the order of 1,000, maybe a little more than that per day. So we're continuing to grow our inventory.
Who determines that the numbers, I guess, of how, like, how to increase, who determines the increase or decrease numbers?
A very finely calibrated crystal ball.
Logarithm.
So it's a dark art, you know. Basically, sales are this today. They look to be that 6 months, 12 months, whatever from now. We have this much in inventory. If things continue this way, we should have that much. So we look at that big picture, probably, you know, indeed, you know, we're looking at it continuously, but in detail, probably twice a year, and make adjustments as necessary.
Was this this role your first time of actually looking at forecasting, or did you do that previously in other roles too?
I was involved at other roles, at the other sites as well. Brown-Forman have a guy called Bill Dietrich, and he runs the model. And you know, he would bring out the Siri production plan, but I worked fairly closely with him. And you know, at Angel's Envy, it was, you know, we were so small, so new, there was no existing data to build it on. So I built this very complex spreadsheet that was, you know, I ended up calling it the Wonder File. And it kind of got that nickname. But so, yeah, I've been involved. And it's you make guesses, you make projections, you know, you hope you got it right.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, just age it a little longer.
Yeah, you know? Or you know, hopefully you don't have to age it a little less.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Like, oh, we planned for X, but now, you know, it was actually 1.5X. I'm like, oh shit, what do we do now?
And so to also talk about coming into Heaven Hill, and we talked about the, you know, the breadth of portfolio of just the bourbons and whiskeys that are in front of it. And I'm sure that as the master distiller, like that is your front line of things that you talk about and you're the face for. So where is there like a week-long boot camp where somebody sat you down and said, all right, so we're going to go through everything. You've got to remember every little nuance in the history of them. Like how'd that process go?
It was a little bit of that. So I spent a fair bit of time with the brand teams, and they gave me the PowerPoint decks and the swag and whatever else.
But and flashcards.
Yeah.
they're sitting here and they're like, all right.
The real learning, though.
You got to get 10 in a row.
We mentioned Bernie Lubbers earlier.
Yeah.
He and I have traveled a fair bit together already and, you know, gone to the Whiskey Fest and stuff. And, you know, we've gone and done, you know, trainings at restaurants and bars and, you know, learning it from him and seeing some of his presentations. That's probably where I did most of the learning.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
he's a wealth of knowledge, too.
Oh, he is. Yeah, he's the whiskey professor.
He is.
And he makes it fun to learn.
He really does, yeah.
Last time he was playing Stump the Chump with us.
I know, he made us look like chumps.
Yeah, I know. He was asking us questions. We were like, we weren't paying attention.
No, he's really good at what he does. But, of course, tasting the portfolio, mm-hmm. What better way to learn it?
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, the funniest one is Pikesville Rye, my neighborhood liquor store on Frankfort Avenue. I'd walk by and see Pikesville Rye, and I read it as Pikeville Rye, and I was like, who's making rye whiskey in Pikeville, Kentucky? And then like a month later, I'm the master distiller for that brand, and I'm like, oh shit. Yeah. But then when I tasted that, I was like, holy crap, this is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd known Rittenhouse for a long time, and I love Rittenhouse, but Pikesville kind of takes
you to the next level there.
Way to the next level, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, so you talked about Pikesville. It's like, is there any other like bourbon line that you kind of look at as like, yeah, this is going to be like my staple? Like this. I mean, you've got to kind of give everyone their little bit of love. Yeah. Like, is there a favorite child out of the group from the main brands?
You love all your children the same. So, you know, you think about it, we got 5 mash bills. You know, I think we're the only ones making those 5 mash bills, so the 5 American whiskey styles. And they go into all the different brands. So when we make our bread and butter is H.H. Reg, our rye bourbon. And that goes into Evan Williams, Elijah Craig, Henry McKenna, whatever it might be. So learning that progression, you know, Evan Williams is, you know, it's a 2.7 million case brand. It's the second largest selling bourbon in the world. And it's a, you know, if you look at it, if you compare it to the competition, you know, it's aged longer, it's higher proof, and I think it tastes better. You know, and that kind of, to see how that, you know, ages out and becomes either McKenna or Elijah Craig and how good they are. And either on the rocks, or I've had some fantastic cocktails lately with our portfolio. And it's been a fun journey. But even like I hadn't had much wheated bourbon in recent decades. When I started drinking bourbon, probably one of the very first ones I had was Old Fitz. So find out that we own Old Fitz, and you know, and then we've got Larceny, and you know, been so used to rye based bourbons, and to realize that, you know, these wheaters are actually, they're pretty good in their own right. They're not just like a light whiskey. They are a really good subset or the different side of the same coin type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so of course the old fits, the special editions that we bring out that are 12, 13 years old are just spectacular.
Yeah. And that's what I think is probably, everybody always gets, there's so many brands inside of Heaven Hill. We've been to the label room before. I mean, there's hundreds, if not maybe
there are literally thousands. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's mind blowing, but then, as you'd mentioned, there's an old Fitz release. There's the Heaven Hill 27 year releases and people go crazy for them.
The William Heaven Hills.
Yeah. And the William Parkers. But you're in a unique position because you get to try and sample and taste all these at Barrel Proof and you get to choose which ones they're coming from. So
I get to be part of the,
So it's, that's always a fun experience because like I said, you get to do like the real unicorn part of it. Yeah. Right. You might not get to see the empty or the final packaging of it, but you get to see the process from really like where it started up until that point too.
No, it's really cool. Like we were doing a barrel selection, for Julio's Liquors yesterday and we were tasting some, 12-year-old at 151 proof. Mm-hmm. And
you got to change the barrel picks to barrel proof, man. we got to do it. It kills me. Like
we'll start the petition.
Every time I go to Elijah Craig, there's three great. Like it's always the hardest barrel pick because there's three stunners from Deedsville or whatever, and you're like, gosh, I don't want to water this down, but I understand.
You take it to 94 proof and you're comparing apples to apples.
Right.
You know that it's not just like the proof or the color that's kind of changing your mind. It's like, all right, I know that I am comparing the same thing to the same thing to the same thing. So you're getting honest whiskey.
Yep.
And so one of the last things I kind of want to wrap it up with is kind of a fun question. Because I want to understand like what your thought process was when this first happened. So you're going to be in front of a lot of people, and I'm sure you've gone and you've made your rounds at the Whiskey Fest. And there's always it's a responsibility of a master distiller or a brand ambassador, whoever's the face of the brand, to sign the bottles.
Yeah.
so kind of talk about what it was to like sign your first bottle and go, okay, I've been here for like 2 weeks. So what was that experience like?
So it's kind of mind blowing to be honest with you. At Whiskey Fest Chicago, I think it was. We have that partnership with Goose Island. So me and Bernie and Mike Smith from Goose Island were doing a presentation on basically barrel aging and da da da. And afterwards, somebody came up and asked me to sign their ticket or their program or something. And, my first reaction was like, seriously? But of course, I that was in my head. But, you play the role. I mean, this person has spent their hard-earned money to come and listen to me yap about whiskey. So like, thank you so much. I'm honored to sign it. But it's pretty cool. Our Evan Williams hero program where we recognize veterans. We're down with Chris Cruz at Cruz Customs Flags last week, and he asked me to sign a bottle, and he's put a ton of pictures of it on Instagram. And I'm like, anyway, you're the cool guy. Stop making me look bad. I just scrawled on the bottle, But so it's honestly, it's gratifying, but at the same time, it's a little shocking that.
Right.
Signature, really?
You really want that?
Yeah, because I remember it was at the Heaven Hill Select Stock 18-year release, and I saw you there, and people were lining up to get your signature. And it was just kind of dawned on me, and I was just like, he wasn't here 18 years ago. But it's so funny that like people, they gravitate towards you and they want that as sort of like a recognition of
it's
like,
it's pretty funny, And that's the role, and it's, I kind of enjoy playing it.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun. But like the, you mentioned
celebrity
18 years ago, the 2 weeks after I start, Henry McKenna wins best whiskey in the world. And, all these people are interviewing me and say, what's it like to me? And I was like, I had nothing to do with that whiskey, but it's very cool that I'm here. And of course, the original Henry McKenna was Irish and I'm Irish. So maybe he's smiling down.
Look at the Irish. Yeah. Right.
Look at the Irish. There it is.
It always comes back to look at the Irish.
Absolutely. That's a great way to kind of wrap that up there. So Connor, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was a pleasure. Like I said, just to get to know you, I think it's an opportunity for people to really see the real personal side of you. We just talked before we started recording. We all live in like the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
We all drink the same whiskey now too, so it's always fun. And
well, let's go to Red Dog and have a cocktail.
Yeah, yeah. Well, definitely. But seriously, once again, thank you for coming on and doing this. And you know, Ryan, I think this is a great opportunity for us to get to know Connor and understand really his background and you know what he brings to the table here at Heaven Hill too.
Yeah, it's a cool story. I mean, like from Dublin to Bardstown, you know.
Yeah.
Who would have thought?
Who'd have thunk? Who'd have thunk?
But no, I mean, I'm Heaven Hill is like in my heart because I'm from Bardstown. My ton of family members work there, and like just after meeting you and talking with you, I know it's in good hands, and that's
that's
reassuring. And so I'm glad that they chose you and you decided to call them back, and appreciate you taking the time to spend with us. And yeah, if anyone has show suggestions, comments, feedback, we love hearing from our listeners. So just let us know, and we'll see you next time.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.